Claude Schaeffer analyze the archaeological finds of every place excavated from Troy at the Dardanelles over all Asia Minor, Armenia, the Caucasus, Persia, Syria, Cyprus, and Palestine to Egypt in Africa. He summarizes his extensive volume thus: "Our inquiry has demonstrated that these repeated crises which opened and closed the principal periods of the 3rd and 2nd millennia v.e. are not caused by the action of man. Far from it, because compared with the vastness of these all-embracing crises and their profound effects, the exploits of conquerors would appear only insignificant." Schaeffer's work sheds a new light on the conclusions at which Sir Arthur Evans arrived after many years of archaeological work on Crete. The island was shattered in violent catastrophes that were accompanied by fire, and in these upheavals the cultural and political ages of the Minoan kingdom went down, at the same time that corresponding Egyptian ages were terminated. Troy III was destroyed and its 50 feet thick fortress wall fell when the Middle Kingdom in Egypt fell. The volcano on the island of Thra exploded with almost unimaginable fury. Recent archaeological work in the Indus Valley showed, too, that about 1500, and in advance of the Aryan invasion, cities with great walls were destroyed and a flourishing civilization came to a sudden end. The synchronization of the Exodus with the end of the Middle Kingdom was also the starting point of a reconstruction of ancient history from that point on to the advent of Alexander the Great, which took the form of a two-volume work, Ages in Chaos, the first volume of which was published in the spring of 1952. The problem of the time of the Exodus in Egyptian history had never been solved. In the papyrus Ipuwer and the Nose of El Arish I found descriptions of a natural upheaval very similar, sometimes identical, with the description in the Book of Exodus, following plagues, when the river was blood-colored, amid a hurricane and darkness of 7 days' duration, the Pharaoh and his host were drowned in a whirlpool at Pi Ha-Kirith, the same place where the Pharaoh of the Exodus was drowned. These parallels compelled me to fix an unorthodox date for the Exodus. Collating the historical texts of following generations for 1200 years, I could establish numerous correlations between the histories of Egypt and of Israel which could not be accidental. My reconstruction demonstrated that Egyptian history and the histories of the nations which are written in harmony with it are out of line with the historical past by about 600 to 700 years. Thus both my works have their starting point in the recognition that the Middle Kingdom in Egypt went down in a great natural catastrophe. The recent excavation in Jericho has confirmed the fact that the great walls of the city fell a few decades after the end of the Middle Kingdom. But at the time in which conventional chronology places the arrival of the Israelites under Joshua in Canaan, there was no city at Jericho and no walls to fall. According to Ages in Chaos, however, the Israelites came to the walls of Jericho one generation after the end of the Middle Kingdom, and the enigmatic hiatus of 600 years proves not to be real. I expect new evidence from the Minoan scripts and the so-called Hittite pictographs. Texts in the Minoan script were found years ago on Crete and in Mycenae and in several other places on the Greek mainland. I believe that when the Minoan writings unearthed in Mycenae are deciphered, they will be found to be Greek. I also claim that these texts are of a later date than generally believed. No dark age of 6 centuries duration intervened in Greece between the Mycenaean Age and the Ionian Age of the 7th century. Before long, new evidence will come from the so-called Hittite pictographic writings found in Asia, Minor Mesopotamia, and northern Syria. Since the recent discovery in Karait in Asia Minor of bilingual inscriptions, in ancient Hebrew and in pictographs, efforts at decipherment have entered a new stage. Today the Hittite pictographs are already in the process of being read. In my reconstruction I come to the conclusion that they are Chaldean signs, not Hittite. I also expect unequivocal evidence that these signs were used down to the last century before the present era. Owing to the confusion in the conventional chronology, the Chaldean writings of the Neo Babylonian Empire are ascribed to early centuries and an imaginary empire. W.F. Libby and his associates at the University of Chicago have developed the radiocarbon method of dating organic matter. Wood from under the foundation of the Hittite fortress of Alisar in Asia Minor turned out to be 700 to 800 years younger than conventional chronology would allow, thus giving full support to my dating. Hittite history, interwoven with Egyptian history of the New Kingdom, cannot be shortened without at the same time shortening the history of Egypt. The age of pieces of wood from the tombs of the Old and Middle Kingdoms in Egypt also proved to be in harmony with my reconstruction. However, for the decisive period, that of the New Kingdom, no radiocarbon analysis has been made. In Worlds in Collision, p. 329, I expressed my belief that human settlements would be discovered farther to the north on the Kolyma or Lena rivers flowing into the Arctic Ocean. On the lower Lena, north of the confluence with Vili, inside the polar circle, monuments are found of a characteristic culture. Outstanding finds were made near the Lake Yolba, not far from Jigansk. As soon as the archaeologists started a methodic investigation of the area, in Yakutsk itself was found a workshop of an ancient metallurgist in which, at the end of the second millennium before the present era, he made bronze axes similar to the axes manufactured about that time in the Near East and in Europe. In the Yakutsk taiga 2,500 or 3,000 years ago, there already lived artisans in metals who were able to extract copper from ore, to melt it and pour it into forms, and to make axes, beautiful bronze tips for the spears, knives and even swords. These relics of a civilization in the taiga of northeastern Siberia imply that the climate changed there in the age of advanced man. Before the ice froze the region, voracious members of the elephant family roamed there in large herds. Recent finds in geology. Archaeological evidence of continental upheavals in the second millennium having been presented in detail by Schaefer, the evidence of geology and paleontology call for elucidation. To this I have dedicated a special work, now close to completion, and since it will be published before very long, I shall refer here only briefly to some of this material. A little over a decade ago it was observed that the gold-digging hydraulic giants in the Fairbanks district in Alaska, sluicing out miles, long cuts, opened great hecatombs of animals. Their numbers are appalling. The Bronze Age may have been well on its way in the centers of ancient civilization. Palms were found to have grown in northern Greenland, where now for half a year there is darkness and it is permanently cold. At some time in the remote past corals grew in Spitsbergen and Sequoia forests in Alaska, and it was early understood that the terrestrial axis must have changed its position. Airy, Lord Kelvin, George Darwin, and many others, including Schiaparelli and Simon Newcomb, participated in a long debate on the astronomical and geological possibility of a sudden change in the direction of the terrestrial axis, a debate that was erroneously thought to have been started as a consequence of Worlds in Collision. It was understood that such a change must have taken place unless the strange finds are to be left without explanation. The theory of drifting continents, offered as a substitute, was rejected for many reasons. Jeffries showed that the mobile force invoked by Wegener is 100 billion times too small to move the continents. Eddington thought that possibly only the crust, in its entirety, moved, and the axis of the core was left unchanged in direction. But the mobile force he invoked, the tidal inequalities of lunar origin, would not have moved the latitudes out of their places, the directional pull being east, west. W. B. Wright, in his The Quaternary Ice Age, 2nd ed., 1937, says that during geological history there occurred many changes in the position of the climatic zones on the surface of the Earth which cannot be explained except by a shifting of the axis or a displacement of the pole from its present position. But what could have brought about a change in the inclination of the terrestrial axis to the plane of the ecliptic? I discussed this question in the closing pages of Worlds in Collision and suggested the entrance of the Earth into a strong magnetic field. The newly developed science of paleomagnetism brought, and daily continues to bring, confirmation of the fact that lavas and igneous rocks in all parts of the world are reversely magnetized. But what is even more startling is to find that the reversely magnetized rocks are 100 times more strongly magnetized than the Earth's magnetic field could have caused them to be. H. Manley, in his review, writes, "It may seem strange that a rock, which is made magnetic by the Earth's field, should become so strongly magnetized compared with the generating force. This is one of the most astonishing problems of paleomagnetism." Manley also refers to the tests made years ago by G. Folgerator and P. L. Merkinton on the clay of ancient Etruscan vases. They were found to have been fired when the vases were closer to the south magnetic pole. Their position during the firing is known, because of the flow of the glaze, and the magnetic dip or inclination of the clay is found. Manley writes, "This implies that in the 6th century BC the Earth's magnetic field was reversed in the central Mediterranean area." He speaks also of a general reversal in historical times, 2,500 years ago, that must be cleared up by additional research. "Knowing from my study of ancient literary sources the proper time of exogenous disturbances in terrestrial rotation, I suspected an inaccuracy in the last sentence of an otherwise well written article by Manley. The reversal must have occurred in the 8th century and again in the beginning of the 7th century, 687. I was gratified to find, in the original publication of Professor Merkinton, to whom I directed my inquiry, that the vases with reversed polarity date from the 8th century. I expect that, should the research be extended to vases dating from the end of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, circa 3,500 years ago, other periods of unnatural polarity would be determined in Egypt and elsewhere." Professor R. Daly of Harvard University found that 3,500 years ago, all over the world, the level of the oceans suddenly dropped. He thought it might be due to a sudden sinking of the crust. And in an authoritative work, Marine Geology, 1950, Professor P. H. Quinnan of the Netherlands finds that this recent shift is now well established on observations in many places of the world, and he, too, assigns this catastrophic drop of the ocean level to 3,500 years ago. The recent expedition of the Oceanographic Institute at Göteborg, under H. Pettersson, which covered the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans, found, according to its leader, evidences of great catastrophes that have altered the face of the Earth. He speaks of climatic catastrophes, and of tectonic catastrophes, that raised or lowered the ocean bottom hundreds and even thousands of feet, spreading huge tidal waves which destroyed plant and animal life on the coastal plains. At many places, a lava bed of geologically recent origin was covered only by a thin veneer of sediment. He discovered that the Pacific and Indian Ocean beds consist largely of volcanic ash that had settled on the bottom after great volcanic explosions. He also found a large nickel content in the clay of the ocean bottoms, and decided that this abysmal nickel must have been of meteoric origin. Consequently, he concludes, there were very heavy showers of meteors. The principal difficulty of this explanation is that it requires a rate of accretion of meteoric dust several hundred times greater than that which astronomers are presently prepared to admit. Professor Ewing of Columbia University carried on his investigation in the Atlantic. In 1949 he published his results, and, like Pettersson, he found that lava spread only recently on the bottom of the ocean. He also came upon signs of land deep on the bottom of the ocean and concluded, either the land must have sunk 2 or 3 miles, or the sea once must have been 2 or 3 miles lower than now. Either conclusion is startling. The pollen analysis, made by various scientists, of the bottom of the North Sea, between Germany, England, Scotland, and Norway, convinced researchers that this sea in its present shape originated only very recently, in the Surreal. The date of 1500 before the present era often being selected. At that time there occurred a climaster. Once there had been a sea, then it was covered by debris carried from the mountains of Norway. Later, in a catastrophic advance, the North Sea was formed once more. Human artifacts have been found from the time when the North Sea was land. The investigation of the delta formation of the Bear River, on the Alaskan border, very carefully made by Hansen, showed that at the present rate of sedimentation the delta is estimated to be only 3,600 years old. A. Laparent, the leading French geologist of the beginning of the century, calculated that, Since the time the Rhone Glacier started to melt, less than 3,000 years have passed. Modern research confirms that many of the alpine glaciers are less than 4,000 years old. Professor Flint of Yale refers to the redetermination of the age of the Upper Great Gorge of Niagara Falls and writes, 1947, the age of the Upper Great Gorge is calculated as somewhat more than 4,000 years, and to obtain even this low figure we have to assume that the rate of recession has been constant, although we know that discharge has in fact varied greatly during post-glacial times. Cernander and others demonstrated that in 1500 and again after 800 there occurred climatic catastrophes of global dimensions. These researches, unknown to me when I wrote Worlds in Collision, coincide completely with my conclusions and their dating. In both these periods the lake dwellings in Switzerland, Germany, northern Italy, and also in Scandinavia were overwhelmed by high water catastrophes and abandoned, the first time for four centuries, the second time never to be rebuilt. H. Gams and R. Nordhagen showed, with very extensive documentation, that at these two time dates the lakes of Europe were tilted, and many of them, like Isar and Federsee, were emptied of all their water. The Isartal in the Bavarian Alps was violently torn out, and this in very recent times, and in the Inntal in the Tirol many changes of riverbeds are indicative of ground movements on a great scale. Deterra of the Carnegie Institute and Peterson of Harvard came to the conclusion that the Himalayas, in violent upheavals, reached their present form and height in the age of man, partly even in the time of advanced man. The same conclusion is made concerning the Andes, where, too, the upheaval must have been catastrophic. In the age of man the Andes rose many thousands of feet amid volcanic activity. In the hills of Montreal and New Hampshire and in Michigan, 500 and 600 feet above sea level, bones of whales have been found. In many places on the earth, on all continents, bones of sea animals and polar land animals and tropical animals have been found in great melees, so also in the Cumberland Cave in Maryland and in the Chukchen Fissure in China, and in Germany and Denmark. Hippopotami and ostriches were found together with seals and reindeer. Wherever we turn our interest, from the Arctic to the Antarctic and from sunrise to sunset, in the high mountains and in the deep seas, we find innumerable signs of great upheavals, ancient and recent. A circular meteoric crater, Chubb Crater, was discovered in the summer of 1950 in northern Labrador. It covers an area of 4 square miles. It is much larger than the Arizona crater, which is 4/5 of a mile in diameter, 2/3 of a square mile in area, whereas the Arizona crater could accommodate 2 million people in its amphitheater, the Chubb crater could accommodate 12 million people. It must have been created by the impact of an asteroid. According to the published opinion of geological authorities, the asteroid must have fallen about 4,000 years ago. Following, or shortly preceding, the discovery of the Chubb crater, several other large meteoric craters were discovered in Australia, Arabia, and Mexico. The tens of thousands of oval formations on the Atlantic coast of the United States, especially in the Carolinas, some of them attaining a length of a few miles each, were conclusively identified, in a monograph by Putti, 1952, as having been caused by the fall of large meteorites. And finally, the largest of crater formations, situated in Quebec north of Sept-Lise, in Canada, and occupying an area of 680 square miles, is under investigation as to its meteoric origin by a group of Mines Department scientists led by Dr. Innes. Of the many other new developments in the field of geology, I would stress some of the results obtained by the radiocarbon method. The time of the Ice Age is moved much closer to our time. Instead of 25,000 years as a terminal date of the last glacial period, it is shown that 10,000 or 11,000 years ago the ice was still advancing, and even with this low dating there remain puzzling exceptions, among them the finding of mastodons and mammoths in strata only 3,500 years old. Moreover, organic vestiges in the drift of the last glaciation have been found to be of radiocarbon age, pointing to a time 3,500 years ago. Radiocarbon analysis of oil has also shown that in the deposits of the Gulf of Mexico, the age of oil is measured in thousands of years, not millions. This destroys the main argument the geologists have raised against the theory of the exogenous origin of some deposits of oil. Hydrocarbons have been identified in cometary tails by spectral analysis, also carbohydrates. But here we are already outside the domain of geology and in the realm of astronomy. Worlds in Collision and Recent Finds in Astronomy. In the years when the manuscript of Worlds in Collision was in the hands of the Macmillan Company, accepted for publication though not yet published, 194,649, and in the years following its publication in 1950, several fundamental observations were made and explanations offered that have a clear bearing on the theory of that book. The zodiacal light, or the glow seen in the evening sky after sunset, stretching in the path of the sun and other planets, ecliptic, the mysterious origin of which has for a long time occupied the minds of astronomers, has been explained in recent years as the reflection of the solar light from two rings of dust particles, one following the orbit of Venus, the other an orbit between Mars and Jupiter, places where, according to Worlds in Collision, collisions of planets and a comet took place. The origin of asteroids, or small planets, that circle between Jupiter and Mars, some of which cross the orbit of Mars and even that of the Earth, has lately been explained as the result of the explosion of a planet and more recently, 1950, as the result of a collision between two planets in an early age, Kuiper. Bobrovnikov of the Perkins Observatory offered anew his own explanation of the origin of the asteroids. They are remnants of a gigantic prehistoric comet. F. Whipple, upon calculating the orbits of the asteroids, came to the conclusion, 1950, that two collisions occurred between these bodies and a comet, once 4,700 years ago and the second time 1,500 years ago, or within historical times. These dates of collision in the solar system are of the same order as those offered in Worlds in Collision, deduced the from historical evidence and testimony. C. Tom Bohr, the discoverer of Pluto, explained, 1950, the dark areas and the canals of Mars as resulting from collisions of Mars with asteroids. According to Worlds in Collision, Mars was involved in repeated collisions with large cometary masses. Actually, in January 1950, an explosion observed on Mars was interpreted, by OPIC, as a collision with an asteroid. Clouds of dust of continental dimensions rose and screened surface features of the planet. Struve of Yerkes Observatory, reviewing the achievements of astronomy during 1950, wrote that by a bizarre coincidence in that year a deluge of sound papers on collisions within the solar system followed on the heels of Worlds in Collision. There are two theories concerning the origin of lunar craters. Their size is enormous, nothing comparable is known on Earth. According to one theory, these craters are the result of a collision of the Moon with very large meteorites, of the size of asteroids. According to the other theory, they are volcanic formations. Both theories assume very violent events in which the celestial body closest to the Earth was involved. In Worlds in Collision, I offered the following explanation of the lunar craters, as well as of the seas of lava and the rifts on the lunar surface, during the great catastrophes, when the Moon together with the terrestrial globe passed through the fabric of a great comet and again when, in the 8th century before the present era, the Earth and the Moon were strongly perturbed by Mars, the Moon's surface flowed with lava and bubbled into great circular formations, which rapidly cooled off in the long lunar night, unprotected by an atmosphere from the coolness of cosmic spaces. In these cosmic collisions and near contacts, the surface of the Moon was also marked by clefts and drifts. If the circular formations on the Moon are these bubbles which collapsed, then probably there are smaller bubbles on the Moon that have not yet burst. Dr. H. Percy Wilkins, the English selenographer, actually found over 40 unexploded bubbles or domes on the Moon, several of which lie to the northeast of Copernicus crater. The largest of these is found within Darwin Crater and is 20 miles in diameter, according to an article by F. Benario in Vega, 1953. I have expressed my opinion that many comets are of recent origin, and I have supported this view by reference to the frequency and luminosity of comets in the days of Imperial Rome in comparison to the number of comets visible to the unaided eye in the last centuries. This notion received vigorous confirmation in the extensive work on comets done in Soviet Russia by a leading authority on the subject, Professor S. K. Svyatsky. His research reveals that periodic comets, as observed during recent decades, are losing their luminosity and their matter at a rate so rapid that 50 or 60 revolutions suffice to disintegrate a comet completely. Thus the Halley comet can hardly go back beyond 3,500 years, or the year 1,500 before the present era. In the last century, several comets with short periods have failed to return, having apparently lost all their matter, and a few others actually fell apart before the eyes of observers. The rapid decay of comets excludes the possibility that they have belonged to our solar system from the beginning, or from the time the planets were formed. The theory that sees in comets bodies that derived from other solar systems has been generally abandoned. Svyatsky also shows WHV we must reject a theory of the capture of comets through which our solar system passed sometime in the past. He comes to me conclusion that the comets were born in eruptions from planets, even from satellites like our moon, where circular formations indicate violent events in the past, but the main activity must have taken place on the gases of Jupiter and Saturn are in violent motion despite their low temperatures. Yet the velocity necessary for escape from the Maya planets is so great, 60 km per second from Jupiter, that Svyatsky admits not knowing the mechanism that could in conditions presently prevailing on Maya planets impart this velocity to the exploded matter. Nevertheless, Svyatsky insists that in the recent past conditions on these planets must have been such that this was possible, even if these conditions cannot be defined. In the publications of the Kew Observatory for 1953, Svyatsky says, the history of the planetary system was characterized, we assume, by definitely more rapid changes and more active physical processes than appeared when only gravitational interrelations in the solar system were taken into account. All this is in complete harmony with the conclusions at which I arrived in Worlds in Collision concerning the time, a few thousand years ago, of the birth of comets of short periods and their origin, by eruption from the planets, especially the major planets. There I also explained the forces or conditions that caused the major planets to eject the cometary masses. The near collision between major planets brought about the birth of comets, p. 373. Now my claim, based on historical material, that the composition of the solar system was changed in historical times, is given the support of observation and calculation, the electromagnetic nature of the universe, deduced in Worlds in Collision from a series of historical phenomena, is supported by another series of recent observations. At Evans Signal Laboratory of the United States Army Signal Corps, in Belmar, New Jersey, researchers conducting pioneer experiments on the reception of radar echoes from the moon detected noises coming from the sun. These noises point to discharges of strong potentials. In the fall of 1947, at the meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, Sir Edward Appleton reported that radio noises coming from the sun coincide with solar flares. According to him, a sunspot is the most powerful ultra short wave radio station known, its power being much greater than a million kilowatts. In 1948 and 1949, Donald Menzel produced motion pictures of prominences or explosions of matter on the sun. They were made at the Solar Observatory in Climax, Colorado. The exploded matter rose at a very great speed to immense heights, all the time gaining in velocity, and then descended to the sun, not on a curved path, as a missile would do, but by retreating on the path it had covered, comparable to a missile reversing its direction and returning to its point of departure. Moreover, the velocity of its descent was without the acceleration expected in a fall, and this too was in violation of gravitational mechanics. It has been observed that when protuberances or surges of exploded matter on the Sun run into one another, both of them recoil violently. Such observation was made by Mukimath and Sawyer, and on another occasion by Lyot. The conclusion drawn by E. Pettit of Mount Wilson Observatory, 1951, is that solar protuberances are electrically charged. Above the protuberances, the coronal structure is often bent into the form of an arch, sometimes into several concentric arches.